Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michala Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27. Here we are with our second of our double bill for today, which will be Karen interviewing me about the report that I've written for the project that's all about the research that I've been conducting over the past 3 years with British citizens living in France. And without further ado, I will just hand over to Karen.
Hi, Michala. I'm going to jump straight in there and I'm going to ask you, how do you feel now that you've just finished that final report?
I think that I feel that after 3 years of doing this research, I've only now really started to make sense of some of the confusion, of some of the uncertainty that we were witnessing right at the outset. I mean, I could always understand the kind of the shock and the outrage, but making sense of that continued uncertainty. I mean, it's been a very difficult time for lots of reasons, but really trying to get below the surface of that, beyond just the, okay, well, the Brexit negotiations are really drawn out kind of thing, has been quite a challenge, I would say. I mean, it was really clear why that uncertainty might happen, but it was also not so clear what could have been done to kind of reduce that uncertainty. And I think now that we're at the end, I can see a little bit more clearly what could have been done differently. Just for clarity, it's not because I believe that Brexit is over for British citizens who live in the EU, because it clearly isn't.
Right. You said it. You feel as if you've now started to make sense of some of the confusion and certain uncertainty. Not that it existing was surprising, although I know that that was did come as a bit of a shock to both of us, the extent of it. But how would you make sense of this confusion and uncertainty now, looking back?
I think that one of the things that we were witnessing over the last 3 years was basically that situation, and we referred to it a little when we spoke earlier about the British in Spain, but that sense in which what people were doing was they were trying to make sense of this for themselves and they didn't know where to turn. And it's not just that they didn't know where to turn, there wasn't any obvious person or institution beyond, of course, the campaign groups who've done a fantastic job stepping in to provide them with that route map. And I remember even in December 2017, so 6 months into the project, after you and I had both been in France and Spain, talking at a roundtable meeting and saying actually that it was the responsibility of governments, whether on the continent or whether in the UK, to actually provide people with clear route maps and to recognise that actually they might have a problem in communicating to a population who was as dispersed around the EU as British citizens are. So I think it was always there, this problem of communicating information on a changing situation. But I think what we witnessed then was from 2017 until the present day, actually, nobody's actually stepped in or stepped up and taken on that responsibility and really thought through what the particular challenges might be of communicating clearly what Brexit means for people in a wide range of situations who happen to be living all over the EU, but who share the fact that they are going to lose their EU citizenship and with it the rights and entitlements relating to that. And I think that it was the sense in which Brexit was so individualised, both in terms of the responses, but also in the fact that actually these people were left to fend for themselves, I would say, that we were documenting.
So in a way, you're saying no one to turn to. I understand that. And that the almost dealing with it was just completely individualised. But why so confusing? Why so uncertain?
I think that there are two sides to this. I think that, first of all, there's been so much information. There's a kind of overload of information that circulates. And I think you mentioned it yourself in our discussions about British people in Spain earlier. you know, we're very used to sifting through information and evaluating what is factually correct, what is not factually correct, what is a reliable source, what is not a reliable source. But I don't think that the same is true for the majority of the population. And I think that's really important. And then if you add to that the fact that what we're talking about is a major legal transformation, all wrapped up in legalese, which, you know, you and I don't understand most of the time. You know, we've had to have people translate that to us.
Absolutely.
Then I think that you are exacerbating a situation. So I think that that was one dimension of it. I also think that that discussion around, you know, trust is really important here, because actually, let's not forget that the draft withdrawal agreement, the discussions around citizens' rights were concluded and wrapped up in March 2018. This is when we received the first, not draft, but the first iteration of the withdrawal agreement around citizens' rights. And yet, between then and actually to very late in January this year, it wasn't clear at all whether the withdrawal agreement was going to pass into law.
Yeah.
And what that basically meant was that people had hanging over their heads the possibility that although these agreements had been reached, and let's remember, they weren't very reassured by those agreements, and we spoke to them in March 2018, that actually these may never become the law. And how would that then leave people? So you end up with the political turbulence that we saw around the negotiations, around British politics, for the duration of the Brexit negotiations, actually then interplaying with this uncertainty to generate even greater uncertainty.
Do you think this continued confusion and uncertainty and lack of knowing who to turn to, do you think it's left any long-term damage?
I think it has changed how British people who live in Europe understand their relationship to the British state. And I say this knowing that before Brexit, actually, it's probably not really something that they had reflected on very much. We have to remember that before the referendum, for example, as just one marker, there was a very, very low uptake of the right to vote among overseas citizens. So British citizens who live overseas, they lose the right to vote after 15 years. But even so, the low numbers of people who were registered to vote as overseas electors would probably indicate that they weren't that sure about what their political participation in Britain would mean now that they left. And yet the referendum happens. This is the point at which people suddenly realise that they're disenfranchised. They think this is outrageous for the large part. And I mean, there were campaigns before Brexit, before the referendum, sorry, for that overseas vote to be extended to a vote for life, but they haven't really picked up very much momentum. But subsequent to the referendum, all of a sudden, we start to see that actually the numbers of British people who live overseas who are registered to vote massively increases. There's a renewed energy to that campaign, partly because it's included in the Conservative manifesto from 2015 onwards that they will extend it for life. And I think that the referendum was a turning point through which people realised that things that happened in Britain could impact on them, and that maybe actually they would want that right to vote after all. And that's just one small example, and I've had to reduce it to a kind of kernel of information. But I think that we do start to see them at that point in time actually saying, well, actually, we should care about what the British government think about us and what they permit of us. And actually, who does the British government think its citizens are if me as a British passport holder with full British nationality finds myself without a right to vote because I no longer live in that country? So they start to turn questions back onto those things. And I think that's quite interesting in terms of thinking about what I kind of will, I think, in the future refer to as Brexit as a moment that made a British community across Europe. Because I don't think it was there crystallised in the way that we see it now before the referendum.
This is related, it might not be immediately apparent, but you have a really interesting section in your report about how the people you spoke to started to feel about friends and families. I know that anyone you can talk to about Brexit can tell you that they've had family arguments or friends they no longer want to talk to because they voted differently or whatever. But certainly for some of the people you spoke to, these relationships with their friends and families really raised some profound issues.
Definitely. And I think that, you know, you asked me a question when I was writing the report, which was like, well, why is this different? What does this tell us about British citizens who live in France particularly? Isn't it just common that Brexit has brought to light these family feuds? But I think it was what they focused on in those discussions. And I think actually these stories were essentially stories about their changing relationship to Britain and Britishness. And they became a locus through which they understood what Britishness was or what the limits of Britishness were, you know, in those ways. It brought to light the fact that, you know, even there in sometimes, and, you know, this is by no means the case that this was everyone I spoke to, but sometimes, you know, they would have friends and family who revealed themselves for thinking that they were traitors for having left Britain. Really asserting that idea that to be fully British and to be patriotic is to live here on this island. I say, I'm in Canterbury at the moment, so.
Feels like an island.
And I think that was quite interesting because these are conversations which they'd never previously had. And then family might turn around to them and say, well, you know, what's the big deal? You can just come back. So they reveal in that process an understanding that, oh, well, you know, it's a little bit temporary. They've gone to live in France, but they can always come back.
But that assumption pervades so much of the discourse around British in Europe and British abroad. It's like this assumption that they're somewhere they're not supposed to be or not meant to be or not going to be permanently, and they can just come home.
Or that it's second best.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. Or that they've made a mistake or they've made a choice and they have to deal with that choice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
It's kind of an interesting dimension to those discussions, particularly in a framework when we're talking about Brexit as sociologists, we're often talking about it in terms of the rise of nationalism, in terms of the rise of particularly insular understandings of what it means to be British, of who counts as British.
Yeah, everything around where a border is and who can cross a border freely and who can't cross a border freely, and what meanings are made when people leave a territory and things like that. So that's what we find really fascinating. I think another thing you said in answer to my first question was that it's been difficult at times, and I'd like to just bring you back to that.
I think it's been difficult throughout. I think that one of the things that I think you and I have shared in common over the course of the research has been the challenge of working with people who are understandably and visibly concerned, upset, who can't keep up with what's happening. We haven't always been able to keep up with what's happening. And I think that's made things quite challenging on a kind of a personal level. But I think that there's another dimension of this as well, which is that as academics, we're used to kind of understanding and having something kind of concrete that you can hold on to. I'm working in a situation where the legal framework has been transforming so rapidly and twisting and turning in directions that you never would anticipate has been
challenging.
Challenging.
It's like I often say to people when people flippantly ask me, oh, you've been doing research about British and Brexit. Well, how has it been affecting them? Like, you might just be over a coffee and they expect an off-the-cuff answer. And I usually now say Brexit has affected everybody in some way. For British people abroad, it's affected them in every way. It's their whole lives. It's where they might live, who they might live with, how they feel about where they live, how they feel about where they thought home was or used to be, how they feel about Europe, what their plans they might make for their future. It's not just about Labour or their business, or it's everything.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's the way that you can see that in the conversations that we've had with British citizens who live abroad is what really stands out. And I guess actually that confusion that we talked about at the outset is central to this, because it's confusion about everything, even things which, as you said, when we talked about British people in Spain, have on paper and in law been partially resolved. And I think it's paying attention to that. I mean, what we could have done and we haven't done is gone, well, you know, the withdrawal agreement's there, it's all going to be fine, which is, of course, one of the very common responses that British people who live in Europe report when they speak with friends and family, particularly friends and family who don't agree with them politically. But actually, listening to people and listening to the confusion and trying to make sense of the confusion makes very clear how deeply this has caused people to question everything that they thought they could take for granted previously, or everything that they had taken for granted, because you never think about the things that you take for granted.
And it goes back to what you said, okay, there are a lot of people now who are okay and now that are going to be okay. It's worth pointing that out. But they still have the damage of the last 3 years to live with.
I think that's really important. And I mean, the one that sticks with me is a couple that I worked with in rural France, who, when I first met them, had already applied for French citizenship and waited for 18 months before they received their French citizenship. And their email to me, it was just a one-line email when they received it, was, "We're writing to let you know that we now have our French citizenship. We can now cope with Brexit." And I think that, I mean, this is a really extreme response to apply for citizenship in another country as a way of securing the rights that you already had in law.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that, you know, this is a very, you know, highly educated couple with, you know, plenty of resource, who probably on paper, you know, if you started to, you know, lay it out, would have been fine with or without French citizenship. But the uncertainty that Brexit introduced to their lives, the turbulence that it introduced, led them to the situation where actually they thought that this was the solution. And it turned out to be a psychological solution.
Very interesting point. Yeah. Another thing that's very important in your report is the uneven effects of Brexit. Do you want to just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that this kind of goes back to talking about the kind of local context in France. And France, how do we put this? It had a non-obligatory system of registration for British citizens, for EU citizens. And by that, what I basically mean is that although residence permits exist in law for EU citizens, actually the French government didn't do anything to actively encourage people to do it. So it's not like in some other countries where in order to access healthcare, you would have had to have a residence permit first, or in order to get a rental property, you would have had to have a residence permit first. They kind of took it on trust that if you're a British citizen, actually many other EU citizens living in France, that you had a right to these things. So in that respect, the conditional terms of freedom of movement were very rarely enforced in respect to British citizens who lived in France before Brexit. And what this means is that in a situation where the future status of these British citizens relies on them being able to demonstrate lawful residence, that actually what you suddenly have is this rush for people to get residence permits. And in the early days, when I was first there in 2017, people's experience was very patchy. They were still being turned away. They were still being told they didn't need them. They were also being told that what use would they be anyway? Because if Britain left the European Union, they would no longer be EU citizens and therefore their cards would be invalid. And part of this is because local government officers who were responsible for issuing residence permits to EU citizens, to non-EU citizens, so to third country nationals, were so unfamiliar with this regime of issuing residence permits for EU citizens. And also, it is not their day job to deal with Brexit. Actually, they didn't know what the advice to give them, what would be the best routes for people. And so this generated a whole other layer of confusion. And it's not until much later in the negotiation that it starts to become official French government policy to tell British citizens to get these residence permits as EU citizens. But of course, then you're talking about a population that by government estimates is somewhere in the region of 150,000, could probably be more than that, let's be frank, who then all need to get these residence permits. Okay, so what that means in terms of the unevenness is also interesting, because in the process of people going to apply for these residence permits, and I'm not going to have time to talk about the fact that actually there are all sorts of other issues that have emerged subsequent to this, where the French government have tried to introduce new ways of registering, and that currently the kind of electronic system is not up and running and won't be until this year. But what this means is that people went in good faith to apply for their residence permits. And then, again, in the hands of local government officers who are not used to doing this, judgments were made about whether people fit and met the conditional terms of residence. And some people were judged to be unlawfully resident. So basically, to not have lawfully exercised freedom of movement.
Retrospectively.
And this is always likely to be the case when suddenly people are scrutinised for their right to be somewhere. And there'll be a range of reasons why that would be the case. People who were ill, people who were in receipt of benefits, various things. And, you know, you could say, you could straightforwardly say, oh, well, in law it says this. But we also know law is interpreted by local government officials in a variety of ways. And I think that, you know, the veracity of this happening on a kind of slightly more widespread scale can be seen in the following two things. First of all, the French government has been taken to court by ECAS for its failure to produce, to issue residence permits to British citizens at a much earlier stage in the negotiations. And last week, the International Organization of Migration, which is the UN Migration Agency, advertised two vacancies in France specifically to deal with the case of vulnerable British citizens living in France. And in the minds of the IOM, British citizens who live in France are migrants. And I think this is really, really important. To my mind, that's never happened before. And their job will be to provide outreach and information to British citizens who live in France, which I think is really, is an interesting development.
And I think it's really worth pointing out here that we are not trying to say British in Europe are special migrants, need special attention, are different to any other migrants around the world. In fact, what we're saying is they have been treated and seen themselves as different. And what we're trying to draw attention to is that they are migrants. They need to be included in any analyses and understandings of migration as migrants.
The way I would put it is that until now, they had the legal privilege within Europe of freedom of movement, of being an EU citizen. And when we remove that legal privilege, and I said this all the way back in 2016 when I was presenting work on what I was calling constellations of privilege. But basically what it says is that EU citizenship was one dimension of those privileges. And for some people, the removal of that privilege, of the legal privileges that went along with being an EU citizen, will be enough for them to fall through the gaps. The British population who live in Europe is highly stratified. And while there are British citizens who, as you said already, will be absolutely fine on paper to pass through the regulations, there will be others who, for a variety of reasons, will not. And this doesn't, you know, I've given the example of the legal status. The legal status is a way in which people are boarded. It's a way in which people are made migrants. But we also know that there are a whole load of other judgments that are being made of people, from whether they have a continued right to employment, whether they're eligible for particular jobs. And all sorts of things can come together at a really odd point in time to make people ill-placed to actually demonstrate that they are lawfully somewhere. And I think the case of France is interesting because I'm sure that, unfortunately, we will see articulations of some of the stuff that's been happening in France in other EU member states. This is just the start of things for British citizens who live in the EU. Brexit is far from over for them.
Would you like to finish by saying what you think, how you think things could have been different. In my answer to my very first question, you said, we're now making sense of the confusion, the uncertainty, and understanding how things could have been different.
Yeah, I think that for us, I mean, there's always been that niggling frustration with working on a topic like the case of British citizens who live elsewhere in the world, that nobody really gets why you do what you do. And I think that niggling frustration, apart from being, you know, just a steady stream of annoyance for the pair of us, actually speaks to something a lot deeper. I think that, you know, we've always known that what we do is important for some of the reasons that you outline in respect to kind of, you know, understanding that global migration regimes are stratified, that some people have some privileges and other people don't, but that it's not a straightforward mapping in terms of nationality, for example. But I think that frustration has really come to the fore and kind of, I'm going to say, crystallized in my mind around the fact that apart from a few people like you and I and an increasing number of NGOs and campaign groups, there is such limited understanding of who the British are who live and work elsewhere in the world. And for people listening, again, I've said this so many times, but I'm going to say it again. The British population who live overseas is actually one of the largest in the world per capita in relation to the British population as a whole. And so it is quite surprising that there's so little knowledge. And that is clear in the fact that the British government don't know who they are. As you said in the previous episode, you know, even the ONS are not really that worried about who these people are. But what that means in this situation, where these people's rights are being transformed, is that there was no clear route map, no clear way of thinking through how the impact of this could be communicated to people. Or not even the impact, what people would need to do, how that would be communicated. There was no two-way movement whereby British citizens who lived in the EU could feed in their concerns, their worries, into those discussions, into the negotiations. The British government at the outset said they were committed to, you know, getting, you know, dealing with the situation. The kind of very narrow framing of this around residents also demonstrates the limited understanding that they had about who these people were and how they were living and how they were living in and around Europe, which means that there will be people whose situations are not considered by the withdrawal agreement. And I think that if that had been addressed more conscientiously from the start, then it could have been, some of the confusion could have been avoided and some of the impact could have been minimized. And it's not that there is no knowledge out there. There is knowledge produced by academics such as you and I that could tell them all sorts of things about the kind of local peculiarities of groups of British people, if they are groups. I mean, that's also an issue. And I think that that would have helped, but that call was never made, so.
Interesting, yeah, which probably says a lot in itself.
I mean, I think that it's, when I said things could have been done differently, I think greater care could have been given to thinking about how to include those British citizens in those discussions and to bring their knowledge and their experience of having of living in these other places, the terms on which they lived, into even an understanding of what shape those negotiations might need to take. Recognising that freedom of movement, for example, is an old piece of legislation that fixates on a particular understanding of who a free mover is. And yet people have moved under the mantle of freedom of movement who do not resemble that. I mean, that's for a long, another time. But I think things could have been managed very, very differently. And yet here we are, 3 years on from the triggering of Article 50, nearly 4 years on from the referendum. And I think that there are British citizens who live all the way across Europe who are still navigating the swamp of Brexit. And I don't think that's where we expected anyone to end up after this period of time?
No. It's a kind of depressing end note. I mean, there are some reassurances, yes, and people actually can't live in turmoil, so they take what they can get. And you know, a lot of people are grateful for what reassurances they've got. But there isn't a day goes by that I don't see comments on Facebook pages where people are anxious yet again about something. So it's a fair point. Still lots
of... state of anxiety, I would say.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for a lovely conversation. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Karen. And for those of you listening, if you'd like to consult the report, which covers some of those issues, although not all of them, and many, many more, I will include the link to the report, which is, again, imaginatively entitled. It's exactly what it is on what it says on the tin, Brexit and the British in France. And I'll put the link into the show notes and take a look and let us know what you think. You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast with me, Dr. Michala Benson. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so by searching for Brexit Brits Abroad on iTunes and Libsyn. And to join in the conversation, follow us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BrexpatsEU, and you can visit our Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. To find out more about the project, visit our brand new website, that's brexitbritsabroad.org. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.